Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Jordan Sava.
In this episode, we are joined by Badranath Kaneti, president of the Allina Health Cancer Institute and the chief academic officer for Allina Health, to discuss some of the latest updates regarding PSA testing and recent advancements in the prostate cancer space. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Kaneti. To start, what are the latest recommendations for prostate cancer screening, particularly for men in a community setting?
Right now.
I don't know that it matters whether you're in a community setting or not. Usually most of these recommendations are pretty broad. And there's different organizations that have issued recommendations. You know, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has a recommendation. The AUA has a recommendation. And, you know, the EAU, which is the European Society. So everybody has their own set of recommendations. I'm on the guideline panel for the U.S. Version of it, for it's coming through the American Urologic Association. So the AUA guideline committee for prostate cancer screening, I'm on that committee. And we just released our recommendations earlier last year. And there are some changes compared to what we were recommending before. We're still stating that the decision to undertake prostate cancer screening is dependent on patient preference and should be based off of a shared decision-making between the provider and the patient. Because once you open that Pandora's box, you know, there are several different things that can occur, including diagnoses or diagnostic interventions, treatments, et cetera. But largely, it does seem that the rush to treatment has died down a little bit. So previously, there was a lot of concern that the minute you get screened, everybody gets treated, and there's a lot of overtreatment. So that seems to have decreased a little bit. And as the data are coming out from some of the larger European studies on the benefits long-term of prostate cancer screening, there does seem to be some benefit in terms of reduced cancer spread and even improved survival. Except they're not, you know, as huge as one would have hoped for, but they're still there. So we do recommend that after a discussion with a patient, that patients do get screened for prostate cancer, and the PSA at this point seems still to be the test to use once every other year, you know, maybe less, maybe more, depending on the patient preference and the age. And we do think that you know, screening can start as about age 50 or so and can go on till perhaps 70 and maybe even 75. But beyond that, there's really not great data to advocate for screening beyond a certain age. Though one has to keep in mind, you know, age is a number, and some people are 80 years old or 75 years old, could be really healthy and very fit, and a younger person may be less fit. We do also call out that patients who are higher risk, family history of prostate cancer, African-Americans, for them, you could start screening at a little bit earlier age, even at 45. And you also want to make sure that these people who are in these risk groups, they're notified of their risk, and they take that into account when they're watching their prostate cancer screening. And in some cases, even age 40, to get a first PSA sort of checkpoint may not be a bad idea, particularly in patients with family history of prostate cancer.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for the comprehensive answer.
One other thing I will point out, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force previously had issued guidelines saying that you should not screen for prostate cancer. And that was called a D recommendation, but they've changed that now to a C recommendation. And they're also reviewing the data again. I think we should hear something from them in the near future also. But right now it's a C recommendation, which suggests that you can screen for prostate cancer on a case-by-case basis after shared decision-making with the patient. It's a discussion that should be had, is what they're saying.
Just off of that, how has the role of PSA testing evolved in recent years, and what are the limitations to consider?
Yeah, so PSA still seems to be the bedrock of prostate cancer screening. You know, it's not a great marker, but it is perhaps the best cancer-specific marker out there in terms of, you know, a blood test. So, but what we are realizing is that specificity of PSA is not very high, so which means that, you know, somebody with a PSA between 4 and 10, one in four of those patients will have a positive biopsy for prostate cancer. So if you biopsy everybody with a PSA in that range, then about 75 out of 100 men will be getting biopsies which will be negative. So one could argue those are needless biopsies that are being performed. So we realize that's one of the limitations of PSA. The specificity, particularly at the lower ranges, is not very high. We've also started to realize some other metrics around PSA that we were using before, such as PSA velocity, which is the rate of change of PSA year over year. If it was a certain rate over 0.75 nanogram ml per year, we thought that was a concern, nanogram per ml per year, that was of concern and should drive a biopsy. But, those don't seem to be bearing out in further studies. There are certain other things around PSA. PSA density, for example, does seem to be a good marker that we can continue to use and focus on. So we're getting a better understanding of the limitations of PSA. And we're also realizing that there are other factors or other secondary tests that can be used, which can enhance the specificity of the initial PSA and perhaps reduce unnecessary biopsies. So there is something called the prostate health index. There's a test called pro-PSA. There's a test called 4K. And what at least the guideline committee I was involved in did suggest that one can use some of these alternative second level tests after discussion with the patient, particularly before repeating a biopsy. So if a patient has an elevated PSA, undergoes a biopsy, which is negative, and now you have a follow-up and the PSA is still elevated or goes up further, what do you do now, right? So that's when, ideally you want to use some of these alternative tests first before you jump to another biopsy, because you want to avoid repeatedly biopsying patients if they don't need it. The other thing that has also come into play is imaging. MRI of the prostate in particular has gotten so sophisticated and so widespread and widely available, with more and more people gaining expertise. I think at least in Europe now, somebody who presents with an elevated PSA, the first next step is to perform a prostate MRI. And the real idea there is the prostate MRI not only helps you determine if there are areas that are suspicious in the prostate that can be a target for a biopsy. Potentially, if there is no targets for a biopsy, that means that the patient either has no cancer or only has cancer that's not very aggressive, because most of the aggressive cancers can be found on the prostate MRI. That is, a Gleason grade group 2 or higher cancer can be usually identified on the MRI. So if the MRI is completely normal, then maybe you can avoid a biopsy altogether. And that is, one of the ideas that's being promoted more in Europe. We're not there yet completely. Our guideline didn't fully endorse that approach of getting an MRI before the first PSA, at the first PSA elevation before performing a biopsy. We're still waiting for some of the data to come in, but the MRI is definitely a great adjunct to follow patients who have an elevated PSA and a negative biopsy, to better stage the cancer if they do have cancer and so forth. So it's becoming a very valuable tool. One, to guide where to biopsy, but also to even perhaps guide the decision-making around whether to biopsy.
Perfect. Thank you for that. And I guess before we move on to the different treatment options available for patients, is there anything else that you'd want to discuss that's available for diagnosing patients with prostate cancer beyond the PSA test?
One thing that we have to keep in mind, I mean, I mentioned several of the markers. We talked about MRI, talked about PSA manipulations, different ways to look at the PSA, whether it's PSA density, age-based PSA velocity, et cetera, and free to total PSA ratios. Free to total may still have some value. For sure, PSA density has some value. The other thing to keep in mind also is genetics. I think we're getting a better appreciation of the importance of genetics in, one, the occurrence of prostate cancer, but also in the biologic behavior of prostate cancer. We know that we know now that prostate cancer is associated with certain genetic traits, such as the BRCA gene, because BRCA is also associated with breast cancer. So in men whose mothers or grandmothers or sisters, et cetera, have breast cancer or ovarian cancer, they may also be prone to getting prostate cancer. So there is a genetic association with these DNA repair genes. They're called DNA repair genes. So when you have DNA repair gene mutations, they put you at a greater risk for developing several cancers, including prostate cancer. And now, I think when people come in with a family history of these types of cancers in their family, we're more prone to sending them to genetic counseling, obtaining their genetic their germline genetic profile to see if they have any of these mutations. Because if they do, then that changes our understanding of the aggressiveness of their prostate cancer if they were to be diagnosed with it. It may also affect our recommendation for screening. There we say, you may want to get screened for prostate cancer, perhaps at an earlier age even. And it also changes our decision-making regarding treatment. So I think the greater awareness and upfront engagement with genetic counseling is becoming more prevalent.
Thank you for that. Can you give a brief overview of the different treatment options available for patients, and what are the factors that play a role in determining what's best to use for an
Sure.
individual patient?
So obviously, treatment for any cancer, including prostate, is really based on what we think the extent of the disease is, or by common knowledge, what the stage of the disease is, right? So if the stage is what we will call regional, it is in and around the prostate, there's one set of treatment. If it's spread and gone well beyond the prostate, so let's say it's stage four, then the treatment options are different for that. So if it's And the other thing that we have to keep in mind is the grade of the disease. So the grade actually determines the aggressiveness of the cancer. So if you have cancer that's not very aggressive, and that is the aggression of the cancer is now measured based on grade, and we have grade groupings which go from one to five. It used to be called Gleason grade before, and now that we're using more of a grade grouping formula, that is the most recent iteration of it. So you have grade group one, two, three, four, and five that corresponds to Gleason scores of six, seven, seven, eight, and higher. So what we've done is decided that, for over time, there's been many studies in Sweden and UK and even here and the VA system, which have shown that for not very aggressive prostate cancer that's clinically localized to the prostate, it's only grade group one. In those patients, a majority of them probably, don't need treatment at all. And we can just watch them for a long time and nothing happens. Cancer is what we call indolent, so it doesn't, sometimes it won't even grow big. Or if anything just grows big in the prostate but doesn't cause any other problems, and it almost certainly won't spread. So we can just watch these people because they're likely to succumb to something else. But once, and some of the grade group two will also behave like this and probably are going to be relatively benign. But once it gets to grade group three or higher, we think those are patients who need treatment, particularly if they're in the local area, then you need more aggressive local treatment in the form of surgery or radiation therapy. There are newer treatment options coming into play, particularly for those with the grade group two disease and some large volume grade group one disease, where we can use cryotherapy, ultrasound therapy, radio frequency ablation therapy, electroporation, so all sorts of what we would call minimally invasive treatments, where we don't cut the patient in any way. We don't use radiation, but you just stick a needle into the prostate and destroy the prostate in one way or the other. The other advantage in these cases is you can do what we call focal therapy, where if the cancer's the largest cancer is only on one side, you can only destroy the one side or one part of the prostate, and so forth. If the cancer is grade group three or higher, for sure you need to take out the whole prostate along with some lymph nodes that are on the prostate, or you can do radiation therapy with or without hormone therapy. The hormone therapy is to shut down testosterone using injection agents and oral pills. Sometimes we do a combination of both. Now, once the cancer has gone outside of the prostate, then, if, especially if it's spread to the bones and so forth, so the mainstay of treatment is still hormone suppression, where we basically are trying to completely get the testosterone level to zero, either with injection therapy alone or with pills and injections. And then subsequent to that, you have different types of hormone therapy, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, et cetera. One thing to also keep in mind is we talked about MRI, but there are other types of imaging that have also come into play, PET scan in particular, with different tracers. Pylarify is one of them. Gadolinium-linked PSMA PET scanning is another one. They're both different tracers, but they give great imaging. In some countries, they're using it even at the time of diagnosis to see if you can see the cancer in the prostate and in and around the prostate. In this country, more often than not, we use it in somebody who's had treatment and it looks like the cancer is coming back or the PSA is going up. And of course, if you suspect cancer has spread beyond the prostate, then you certainly want to get that. Particularly useful in patients with higher grade disease. So if they have grade group 3, 4, or 5, I think that's when some of these scanning elements really come into play, whether it's MRI or PET scanning. And then the our improved understanding of genetics, particularly with the DNA repair mechanism and mutation genes, DNA repair gene mutations, is we understand that people with some of these specific mutations may be more susceptible to certain types of oral chemotherapy. So there's been, at least two or three drugs recently all approved for these patients with advanced disease who may be more. Unfortunately, it's a very small subset, less than 10, maybe even 5% of patients who are good candidates for this. But in the right candidates, these treatments work really well. Otherwise, the mainstay is some form of hormone therapy. If that fails, we can try gene therapy, which is some useful in some cases. Then more often it's chemotherapy of some sort. And there are some immunotherapies that have been tried as
That was a really great overview. Thank you so much for all of that. And you did touch upon it, but how are minimally invasive and robotic-assisted surgical techniques impacting the treatment in community settings?
Sure. So obviously now, for local treatment, particularly if it's surgery, almost all prostate cancer surgery to remove the prostate is being done using the robot. There's a lot of developments in the robot with several new companies coming out with robots, with different approaches to robotics to make it easier and so forth. In this country, Johnson and Johnson is trialing a robot. Medtronic is trialing a robot. There are some Korean companies that are coming out with robots. So you'll have a lot more than just the Da Vinci robot that can be used. But the technique is still pretty much the same. It is to remove the whole prostate and so forth. There are some people trying this idea of a partial prostatectomy with just taking one half the prostate out to see if that decreases the side effects and still achieves the same purpose. The minimally invasive techniques are perhaps even more interesting in that, like I mentioned before, you can destroy one portion of the prostate, one focus in the prostate, the whole of the prostate, and there are several ones, several different ways, and all of them involve, some ablative technology. And you can use cold, you can use heat, you can use radio waves, you can use electroporation. They're all basically just trying to kill tissue. And cryotherapy's been around since the 1950s. Just getting much more precise doing that. Electroporation is relatively new and has been used in other areas. It's been used, for example, in the liver and other areas. Radio frequency ablation has also been used. Ultrasound has been used to ablate other areas, including brain tumors. So that's a technique. There are vasoactive peptides. You inject something that only gets activated in the prostate. So just, and then the steam, which has been used to destroy benign tissue in patients with enlarged prostates. Now they're using that to destroy cancer. So they're just, they're all, the concept is the same, to just destroy tissue. Question is what energy source you're going to use and how precisely can you control it so it doesn't damage the nerves or the urinary continence control mechanism, so forth. So that's what's getting refined. And then the other question is longevity, because there's always a trade-off. Yes, even with radiation, with everything, you can certainly kill cancer cells, and just burn them completely out. Except, when you do that, the fallout or the damage to the surrounding structures may be so high that the side effects are not tolerable. So that's the balance. How much do you want to burn? How thoroughly do you want to destroy the tissue while avoiding damage to any of the surrounding structures? And it's a pretty delicate balance because there's so much stuff in and around the prostate.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And how is personalized medicine impacting prostate cancer care, and what advancements do you think we can expect to see in the near future?
Yeah, so I think just like every other area of cancer medicine, personalized medicine is making a big inroad into this. It's affecting screening, as I mentioned before. We're getting better at, screening people or getting into screening people at an earlier age, identifying people who are at higher risk for prostate cancer, and maybe taking a different approach to identifying, testing them, diagnosing them, and managing them. We're getting better at identifying people who may be subsets of candidates for different types of treatment, so we can tailor the treatment approaches to them. And for example, in patients who come in with cancer that's already spread beyond the prostate, I think now it's almost a given that they're going to get germline genetic testing because we understand that that can help drive choice of therapy. So I think we're, and some of the treatments, for example, immunotherapies, are better targeted towards some patients who have, or you may get better responses in patients who have, certain changes like, PD-L1 expression, and you won't get response in those who don't. So we're realizing all of these. We're still not there yet, as perhaps some other cancers are, where you're almost directly driven by some of these genetic measurements, because the validation studies still need to be done. And there's also at least 3 to 5 tests that are gene panel tests on the tissue. So you can look at somatic mutations and predict, even in a negative biopsy, what is the likelihood of the next biopsy being positive? Or you can predict, this patient going to have more aggressive cancer. What is this patient's disease pathway going to be like based on the gene mutations in the biopsy sample that you have? So you can upfront say, okay, should I watch this person or should I treat this person? You can also use an analysis of the genetic expression profile of the biopsy tissue to say if somebody going to respond to chemotherapy, to radiation therapy, to hormone therapy. So it gives you more and more indication. I don't know that we are there yet where people have enough confidence in this kind of testing as to let that drive decision making. They will use it in a supportive fashion, but let's say somebody, the genetic profile says this is going to respond to hormones and not chemo. Are people willing to forego the chemo and go a different direction? I don't know that we are there yet on a routine basis because we need some larger, robust studies to be able to conclusively establish that before we can go to the
Definitely
cloud.
makes sense. Thank you so much for that. And my final question is just what are your expectations for the future of this research and treatment in the next 5 to 10 years?
Looking forward.
Oh, I think we're going to see a whole host of new medications, further improvements in diagnostic technology, whether it's imaging or lab diagnostic technology. Our understanding of the genetic expression profile and association will get better. There may be newer techniques such as gene therapy with CRISPR technology that comes into play. CAR T therapy is already being tried in prostate cancer, so that is going to probably become a reality within the next 10 years. The focal therapies are going to get a lot more sophisticated. So I think the traditional therapies such as radiation and surgery are going to, they were the mainstay, they were the go-to. I think they will be one of, many that, and their proportion will decline relative to the others increasing. And one thing to keep in mind is over the last decade, we've already seen a significant increase in uptake of active surveillance, where we do just watch the patients. And I think that we're going to get much better at doing that too, so that we're not, some patients may need to be watched, some patients may not even need to be watched. So we're going to get much better at refining that, because that also adds to cost and interventions. We're repeatedly imaging people, getting labs, doing biopsies. So we need to avoid that too. So that is also, we're going to get better at doing that. So there's going to be a lot of change. And even in things like radiation, we used to give 6, 7 weeks of radiation. Now we know we don't need to. With SBRT, we can do it in maybe 3, 4 weeks, and maybe that'll even get shorter. So I think it's everything is going to get, we'll get to a point where we are sort of talking about more de-escalation than escalation. Because, with the absence of a thorough understanding of cancer, we used to treat all cancer the same. Now that we're understanding the multidimensionality of cancer and how it can express itself, we're able to better tailor the treatment. So by being able to do that, yes, a subset will need everything thrown at them, but then the others may need a little bit less and a little bit less and a little bit less. So I think we've gone all the way to full escalation. We're going to now work our way back to de-escalation and customization.